Welcome to It's Our Money with Ellen Brown. A look behind the curtain of global finance and monetary control with one of the foremost experts in the field. Author of the bestseller Web of Debt and the Public Bank Solution, Ellen Brown's groundbreaking work began the movement to create new American public banks. We'll look at issues surrounding the world of money and the systems and powers that control it, as well as the progress being made on the public banking frontier. The program is underwritten by Public Banking Associates, a national consultancy of experts advising government leaders pursuing creation of their own public banks at publicbankingassociates.com.
If Congress is going to start letting the central bank have a larger and larger role in various forms of economic policy that in some cases could frankly be described as fiscal policy and not the traditional monetary policy that we think about central banks doing, then let's rethink the shape of this institution and let's think about what we would want it to look like so that it could actually deliver money to people and not just large corporations, to think about what it means if the Federal Reserve decides to do loans to oil and gas companies, what that means for the planet, what that means for the stability of our economy. You know, if the Fed is going to have a larger and larger role in policymaking, let's talk about how we want it to look so that it can actually help shape the economy that we want to see going forward.
That's our guest, Graham Steele, Director of Stanford University's Corporations and Society Initiative at their Graduate School of Business, who recently penned an article for The Hill about how it's time for us to rethink the Fed, that 107-year-old institution that has morphed from a monetary policy player to a fiscal policy determiner, as seen in recent months through its generous funding of all sorts of corporate financial interests and concerns. Graham's article illustrated how the supposed impartial Fed has been making significant choices about who wins and who is left out of our monetary system policies as it doles out trillions of dollars of lending, mostly, as in 2008, to powerful financial interests, while Main Street struggles to get through the multifaceted cataclysm of the COVID pandemic. Hello, and welcome to It's Our Money with Ellen Brown. I'm Ellen's co-host and colleague, Walt McCree, Senior Advisor to the Public Banking Institute. Today, we look at the role of two key components of our nation's monetary system from the perspective of evolutionary change: the Federal Reserve's emerging role as a de facto fiscal policy decider, and a new approach that addresses the fundamental economic function of our payment systems. We talk with Dr. Robert Hockett about his new inclusive value ledger, which, like publicly owned banks, proposes that we need a public payment system. Both of these threads are part of the growing movement to re-democratize public utilities. But today, we're also faced with another layer of financial intersection with public interest, and that is public health. Ellen is actually an expert on this as well, and has a new article out that focuses on the profiteering that is now underway around creation of a vaccine.
Ellen, the world is changing so dramatically around us on so many different levels, and here we find this week that that we're realizing how the money power that operates our government and our economy and all those special interests, how they are tied into this pandemic and what it looks like from a monetary perspective. Your history as a writer and as a researcher really started in the medical field and in pharmacy and the connection between pharmacy and banking and medicine. Your new article is focused on that. Tell us about what you're seeing.
Yeah, well, I did write 10 books on alternative healthcare and the politics of health and the politics of the cancer industry. So I know quite a bit about vaccines. So I've gotten quite alarmed at how fast they're trying to rush through these vaccines, that with this Operation Warp Speed, we're supposed to have a vaccine ready by the end of the year. And they've already contracted for 600 million syringes that are will be preloaded and individually identified by RFID chips, so, you know, trackable in some way. and we don't even have a viable vaccine. So there are two leading candidates, one of which the Department of Health and Human Services has already given $1 billion to, and the other it's given over a billion, and the other it's given $500 million to. So the one it gave $1 billion to was AstraZeneca, which is a British company. Their vaccine is of the traditional sort, so they're using a bit of the actual virus, but they've already done some animal tests. At first, they announced, you know, this is a problem. Both they and Moderna come out with these great preliminary results, and then the stock shoots way up, and then they issue more stock and, sell some of their own and make a nice profit. And then the later results come out, and it turns out they're not that good after all. Well, anyway, AstraZeneca said that the monkeys in their initial tests had survived, for one thing, which was unusual for these things, and had developed antibodies. But then when we got the later results in mid-May, after our Department of Health and Human Services had given them $1 billion, et cetera, it turns out that all the monkeys actually got the virus. So they got antibodies, they developed antibodies, and they still got the virus. And in fact, developing antibodies doesn't show that you're immune from the disease. And in fact, it's this cytokine storm. It's when your immune system overreacts that you get the really bad symptoms. And if you've provoked it already with a vaccine, which many of these vaccines have been shown to do, like the old SARS vaccine, they never managed to get it to market for that reason, that when they got reinfected with the virus, the laboratory animals all died because they got too much of a reaction. So that one's not looking so good. And then Moderna, 2 weeks ago, again, came out with their preliminary human studies. They totally skipped the animal studies. I mean, supposedly they're doing animal studies now simultaneously, but they went right to human studies, and they said their initial results were good, that, you know, this was just safety, and that they, I guess, they had also developed antibodies. So the stock went up by 30%, like in one day, 30%, and the company did a stock offering, and a couple of their big executives made $30 million selling their stock. And then the stock dropped right back down.
Within a couple of days.
Yeah, when it came out that these results were very tentative and didn't really show anything, and you couldn't tell anything from them. And then Robert Kennedy Jr. showed that 20% of the subjects had developed reactions that were so severe they either had to be hospitalized or put on drugs or whatever, you know, quite serious. And that's just after a couple of days. So we have no idea what would happen over 10 or 20 years, which is how they usually test these things to see if, you know, if you're going to get cancer and autoimmune diseases and diabetes and Alzheimer's, all those things that have, you know, there's quite a bit of research connecting them to vaccines of different sorts. So it's just all very risky. And Moderna's stock, then in the end, it dropped down as much as it had gone up. But meanwhile, of course, they made a bunch of money selling a bunch of stock. And there was an expert formerly from the Securities Exchange Commission who went on CNBC, and he said, this is the type of thing the SEC would look at, and that there might be criminal penalties attached. So, you know, it looked like a pump and dump. But the thing is, here you've got the investors who are just looking for a profit. They're not looking real closely at side effects. They just want their investment to be good. You know, everybody wants it to go up. The commentators want it to go up. They want the stock market to go up. And every time you come out with a new vaccine, the stock market, the whole market is raised by this data. And then you've got the politicians who are desperate to get back to work. And so everybody is hopeful. Everybody wants these things to work. So they're just not looking real closely at the side effects. But the Moderna side effects are even worse and scarier because they're using nanotechnology to get their vaccine, which is artificially created, GMO-created sort of protein that mimics the proteins in the virus, and to get it all the way into the cell. I mean, they're not even just provoking the immune system, but they're actually penetrating the cell by stealth. And they've got their start from money from the military, And the military is studying this type of research for biowarfare, that it's the type of thing that you could kill people with, messing around with their genes and penetrating the cell like that. So they say they're doing it for defensive purposes, and we hope that's true. But even so, they're messing around with, you know, the genetic code. And this is all, they're about to impose this on the entire population before we've had any kind of long-term studies of the sort that we used to have. And then meanwhile, the AstraZeneca people are saying their problem is they may not get a vaccine out there in time to test it because the virus is going away. Like, they want the virus to linger long enough that they can test their vaccine. So if the virus is going away, why are we throwing billions of dollars at it? It's just all very, it seems like it's all for money and to prop up the stock market and, you know, and I mean, of course, there are much more nefarious theories going around too, but I won't go into those. But anyway, I just thought I had to throw out some research there just because it was so alarming.
It's really interesting to see how the major institutions that operate the big machinery of our lives, the Federal Reserve, the insurance companies, the banks, Wall Street, all of that stuff, will collude around almost anything to make a profit quick or otherwise. And it's more of the same story with a much different clothing, this one apparently in white lab coats.
Except they were tinkering with the lives of the whole population. That's why it's seems more urgent to deal with
issues. Little things like that shouldn't get in the way of profits, though, Ellen.
Yeah, all for profit.
Well, your article is out shortly, and it's really a very insightful bit of research, so thanks for that. And let's get on now to talking with two very experienced monetary guys, Bob Hockett and Graham Steele, who have been with the Fed and the IMF and who are working in the areas of our money system. So thanks, Ellen.
Yep.
We'll move on.
Thank you.
Okay.
The role of payment systems is central to an economy like ours, which is based on transactions of many sorts. That is, in order for purchases and other exchanges of value to occur, there must be a universally accepted operational mechanism to authorize and substantiate those transactions. Cash is one example of this, obviously, but as you know, most transactions these days take place through a variety of digital exchanges, like credit cards or debit cards or other intermediary platforms like phone-based payment apps, all of them somehow tied to an individual's bank account or some other institutional connection. But what if you don't have a bank account, as is the case for about 25% of the American public? The fallback position for that is too often an extremely expensive option called payday lenders or private check cashing services. These companies typically charge high fees, which make the cost of being poor even more expensive and disabling. So, like banking itself, there is a strong case to be made that we should have a public payment system that acknowledges the essential nature of payment systems as a public utility. Our guest, Dr. Robert Hockett, a renowned economist and policy wonk, has created just such a system. It's a digital wallet that everyone would have and could be deployed by any appropriate government authority, like a state or a city or a nation. And it's now being considered by the New York State Legislature. I asked Bob to tell us what this new digital payment system, which is called an Inclusive Value Ledger, or IVL, what it is and why do we need it.
So one of the problems is one that we talk about a lot, and that is the problem of financial or monetary inclusion, right? Too many people are essentially excluded from the financial system or from the banking system, and increasingly now, of course, also from the payment system, insofar as the payment system is automating or digitizing and becoming more and more electronic, and thereby requiring more and more people to pay fees. Even to spend money. So there's the inclusion problem. A second problem is that there are various forms of value that people generate, or at least are capable of generating and are often inclined to generate, but that they have inadequate incentive to generate in, say, socially optimal amounts, because there's no particular way to kind of monetize that particular form or those particular forms of value generation. So, you know, our thought was if we could somehow reward or compensate those forms of value generation, we might well see more of that value generation and thus, in the long term, actually a much more sort of wealthy state or public. And then thirdly, there's just the basic thought that insofar as we call ourselves an exchange economy or a commercial society, a payment system in any such society really ought to be considered a public utility, an essential public utility, right? Because that's the means by which we engage in commerce or the means by which we engage in exchange. And so if you've got a payment system which is in some sense, you know, sort of not fully available to all or not, you know, kind of fully universal, you're doing an injustice. And again, you're also sort of depriving yourself unnecessarily of wealth. So as you know, right, GDP is simply a measure of transaction volume, and it also is our measure of economic growth. We basically say that we're growing when GDP is rising, we're shrinking if the GDP is falling. And as soon as we remind ourselves that GDP is simply a measure of transaction volume, and then we remind ourselves that if you could speed up the velocity of transacting, then you would by definition be growing the volume of transactions. Then a more efficient, more rapidly working, and more widely available payment system is a sort of an essential conduit to growth or greater growth and prosperity as well. So the idea then was to, you know, solve all three of these problems in a single stroke. And the sort of the insight, I guess, was essentially the insight that a money basically is that which pays in a payment system, right? I mean, people have, you know, since time immemorial have sort of posed the conundrum, you know, what is money? And the way people often address that question and the key to avoiding being, you know, lost at sea when you ask what money is to remember that money is always contextualized. Money isn't just a sort of a free-floating thing. It is a rather part of a kind of set of practices, and the practices that I have in mind in this connection are practices of paying, right? And again, this gets back to the idea that we're an exchange economy or a commercial society. We engage in practices of exchange. That means in a monetary economy, we engage in practices of paying, and money is simply that which counts in fulfillment of a payment obligation or any other kind of obligation. And so it seems to me then that if you really want a better money, you want a better payment system. And similarly, if you want a better payment system, you are in wanting that also wanting a better money. So the thought was then, what if we basically made available to everybody as a kind of right of citizenship or residency, a digital wallet? And with that wallet, you could transact, you could basically transact vertically, as I call it, with a government authority or public fisc. It could be local, it could be state, or it could be national, so that when you make tax payments to that particular public authority, you make them over that system. When you receive benefits or tax refunds or what have you from that public sector, you receive them over that system, and so call that the vertical dimension. And then, if everybody had one of these wallets, you could also add horizontal connectivity or P2P connectivity between these wallets, which would then enable us all to pay and be paid by one another over that same system. So if I owe Walt McRae a certain amount of money, and Walt has sort of kindly let me hold off on paying because I don't have a lot of money at the moment, and then suddenly I receive my tax refund from the state government or the city government or the federal government, and it takes the form of a credit on my wallet, on my digital wallet, I can then instantly, the moment I receive that payment, I can then pay Walt what I owe him sort of horizontally, as it were, right? So I'm credited by the government, which debits its own account. I then, you know, basically push a few buttons, and I now credit Walt's account and debit my account, and all of this would happen, you know, literally at the speed of light, or at least very close to the speed of light. And so that was the basic idea, you know, a sort of a simple, straightforward digital payment system that everybody, or payment platform, I guess we could call it, that everybody has a right to be a part of. Everybody has a wallet that enables them to access. And as soon as you do that, what you're essentially doing is enabling people to engage in value transfer and, of course, value storage. Now, if we think of value transfer and value storage in less generic terms, well, in a sense, what we're talking about is, you know, storage is like a bank account. It's a way of saving. And then value transfer is, of course, a way of paying, and we often make our payments to one another through our bank accounts or via that medium. So first of all, we have a kind of digital banking system if we put this in place. And then, of course, we do have a digital payment system as well. We also now have a very straightforward verification system. That's where the idea of an inclusive value ledger comes into play, because insofar as it's a payment platform, it's a kind of a ledger system. It's a system that keeps track of credits and debits, and it's inclusive of many more forms of value than our current payment system allows for. And so, generically speaking, it's an inclusive value ledger. Slightly less generically speaking, it's a payment platform. And even less generically speaking still, it's a kind of digital savings account and payment account or transaction account system, i.e. it's a kind of digital banking system. And we thought, you know, that would be a great way just to leapfrog immediately into a kind of fully inclusive form of digital banking for everybody, and value remuneration for everybody, and transaction volume increase for everybody, thereby improving the prosperity of the state or the city or the nation. But maybe one final point to make as far as the sort of overall description of this idea is concerned is that at the national level, this could be administered either by the Treasury Department or by the Fed, or it could even be a freestanding thing administered by some other federal entity. And which federal entity you would want to administer it would be kind of a function of how fully you want to integrate it into other systems that various federal instrumentalities are already kind of managing. So if you wanted to integrate it fully into the monetary policy making and execution system, then you'd want at least at some point to turn this into a Fed-administered facility or utility. If you wanted it simply to be used as a way of occasionally providing digital helicopter money to people, but you didn't want it to be sort of part of the regular monetary policy transmission channel, then you could leave it with Treasury, or again, you could have some other entity do it. Now, as it happens, and as you and I have talked about before, the Treasury Direct system that already exists, you know, through which people can open digital accounts with Treasury, through which they would then transact with Treasury in Treasury securities, would be pretty quickly and easily adaptable into a kind of national IVL. And that's why the digital greenbacks proposal that I've got before Congress right now that you're aware of and that we've talked about before is, in a sense, the sort of the initial, or what I think of as first federal version of the IVL. And the reason I wanted the IVL in turn to be implementable at the local or the state or the federal level was that, in theory, it could be done at any level. Ideally, that it would ultimately become a federal facility that would be nationwide, but we don't have to wait for that to get there, right? We could do it at any unit of government while we're waiting, and thereby improve payment practices and payment functionality and the circulation of money and the valuation of value and the kind of growth of the economy in any locality or any state or region or among any compact of states or compact of cities. And so it's meant to be kind of flexible in that sense as well.
It's a really thorough picture of an expansive and I think a brilliant adaptation to what is the private banking system. It sounds to me like it's positioned to be a replacement.
Yeah, it could. I mean, the thought is, you could do any number of things, right? It could, in theory, it could fully replace our system of private banking that basically treats bank accounts as transaction accounts, right, as sort of forming the principal backbone of the payment system. If we wanted to keep the private sector banks at the same time, it's easy enough to do that, right? You could just say, well, look, maybe private sector banks would offer other, bells and whistles that would enable them to keep a sizable deposit base and lots of customers. And it's just that some of that base would sort of siphon off into the IVL. If we were really terrified of, destroying the private sector banking system, we could, in theory, place some kind of limit on the total that people can have in their IVL wallets. You could say, well, no more than $1,000 or $2,000 in an IVL wallet. And if you have any more than that, you have to resort to existing private sector banks. I wouldn't personally favor that, but it would be easy to do that if that's what it took to get a compromise in Congress, to get at least the basic infrastructure in place, right? I guess that's another sense in which it's very flexible, and the flexibility of it, I think, is part of the beauty of it.
That system flexibility is quite extensive. For example, a multi-state or multi-city compact IVL could be arranged between participating entities that could target certain social or economic objectives that could better serve program and project agendas. The IVL, again, that's Integrated Value Ledger, is a very promising new expansion of our monetary mechanisms, which we're likely to see realized in the coming years. Our thanks to Dr. Robert Hockett. Bob is the Edward Cornell Professor of Law at Cornell Law School. He's a former consultant to the New York Fed and the IMF, a policy advisor to several congressional legislators, including AOC and Bernie Sanders, and a number of other accolades that we won't take time to list for you now. We're also proud to have him as an advisory board member to the Public Banking Institute.
It's my pleasure to be speaking with Graham Steele, who is Director of the Corporations and Society Initiative at Stanford Graduate School of Business and previously was a member of the staff of the Federal Reserve Bank of San Francisco. And before that, he was Minority Chief Counsel for the Senate Committee on Banking, Housing and Urban Affairs. And before that, he was a legislative assistant for U.S. Senator Sherrod Brown. So it's great to be talking to you, Graham.
Great to be talking to you as well, Ellen. I've read a lot of your stuff in the past, big fan, so thanks for having me on.
Oh, super, and I'm a big fan of yours because you're writing right up my alley, and I think you know things that I don't know, so I'm really looking forward to getting your answers to some things. So you recently wrote an article called Rethinking the Fed, and I loved your conclusion. I'll just read the conclusion first. Should all of our people have an account at our central bank, as legal scholars have advocated, giving human beings the same access to state-conjured financing that big companies enjoy? State-conjured financing, I love that. Why shouldn't our public bank have a role financing a transition to a sustainable planet, as other central bankers around the world are proposing? So I wonder if you could just sort of summarize first what your thinking was on that article.
Sure, absolutely. Well, there's a broader overarching point that I tried to make in the article, and it was written in a DC publication because I really wanted to. It's really meant as a letter to my former bosses and colleagues on Capitol Hill. That their decision in the CARES Act in particular to delegate a lot of authority to the Federal Reserve to send the Fed effectively $454 billion that then could be leveraged 10 times over again, there are distributional consequences to that, that the Federal Reserve, much as it likes to cloak a lot of the things that it does in neutral market-friendly language, that its choices about who it funds, how it executes monetary policy, and have distributional consequences to that about who gets access to financing that then determines the shape of our economy. And so I wanted to point that out because I felt like that had really been obscured in a lot of the conversation about COVID-19 and about the rescue programs, that it was just sort of a lot of the policy making, a lot of the economic policy making was sort of being outsourced to the Fed without much debate about what the implications of that were. And so what I was trying to then say in the conclusion of that article was, if Congress is going to start letting the central bank have a larger and larger role in various forms of economic policy that in some cases could frankly be described as fiscal policy and not the traditional monetary policy that we think about central banks doing, then let's rethink the shape of this institution and let's think about what we would want it to look like so that it could actually deliver money to people and not just large corporations, to think about what it means if the Federal Reserve decides to do loans to oil and gas companies, what that means for the planet, what that means for the stability of our economy. You know, if the Fed is going to have a larger and larger role in policymaking, let's talk about how we want it to look so that it can actually help shape the economy that we want to see going forward.
Yeah, that's great. I totally agree. You wrote about Larry Fink and BlackRock being the doler of the party that gets to determine who gets the money of this $4.5 trillion that these special purpose vehicles have been allowed to borrow. So they were set up by the Treasury and the Fed together. I'm not sure who is the leading party there, but Larry Fink and BlackRock, the first and only thing they bought so far are exchange traded funds, of which 50% actually were BlackRock's. So, you know, incredibly, you know, an incredible conflict of interest there. But what can we do about it? I mean, that's, to me, it's just so obvious that we have all these conflicts of interest going on, that it's the big corporations that are getting bailed out. And anybody can see that who has their eyes open. But what can we do about it? That's, I mean, even like you're saying, we should rethink the Fed. Now, who is going to rethink it? Is this Congress that would do it? I mean, what, I have all kinds of ideas about how we could redo the system, but getting them implemented, after the 2008 bailout, different people were saying, Thomas Hanna more recently wrote a really good paper on how the next time the banks fail, we should have all these regulations in place so that they would then that we'll say, all right, we'll bail you out, but you have to be public utilities. You have to actually serve the public. But that never happened. The Fed just bailed them out, and now they're making 0% loans. They've just opened up their discount window, come one and all. You know, no strings attached. Use the money for whatever you want. So how do we just stop that train and turn it around? That's my major question.
Sure, yeah. So getting back to your first point about BlackRock, I mean, you know, this is a reprisal for them. They did a similar sort of thing in 2008, administering some of the rescue programs back then for the New York Federal Reserve Bank. And the argument this time around, you know, there was, back then, there was an outcry about outsourcing to a private institution some of those public functions. And there was, again, this time when they were picked to administer those programs, and the response is that the regional reserve, Federal Reserve banks that administer these programs don't have the institutional capacity to do it, and only BlackRock is the only company that is both large enough and sophisticated enough to actually do something. It was sort of like, but the argument is effectively that the Fed has let some of its institutional capacity atrophy to the point that they have to rely on private sector institutions. And so I think it's a false choice to say that either a private company gets to administer these programs or they won't happen at all. I think there is public capacity building that could happen before we find ourselves in these crises. That would actually mean that we don't need to rely on Larry Fink to administer a corporate bond purchasing program that, as you said, then he's purchasing his own exchange-traded funds. That seems like a pretty clear conflict of interest to everyone who looks at it, and yet it's sort of business as usual for a bunch of these rescue programs. So then the question is, you know, what do we do? Who's supposed to do something about it, and what are they supposed to do about it? And I think, you know, I directed my piece at members of Congress because I think that particularly folks on the progressive side, although also, you know, some conservatives should be uncomfortable with this, I wanted them to sort of think through, to be more aware of what the role of the Federal Reserve is and what it could be. And, to, you know, I think sometimes when representatives of the central bank come in and meet with them and make arguments to them or to the public, or frankly, when people from the banking industry, like lobbyists, come in and talk about the way the Fed operates and the way the financial system operates, it's sort of cloaked in the speak and industry jargon and made it accessible to a lot of both members and to staff and to the public. And, you know, I want members to pay more, I want members of Congress to pay more attention and to think about what they would want a central bank to look like. But I also would like the public to be more engaged and to understand a little bit better what the role of the Federal Reserve is in our society and our economy. And that's hard. It's very much an insider conversation right now. But a lot of the work that I do around the financial sector is aimed at demystifying a lot of these concepts so they're accessible to most folks, so that there can be more of an even conversation. So it's not just dominated by a few insiders, be they corporate lobbyists, Wall Street executives, and the like.
Right, that's great. So theoretically, the Fed, its roles are to maintain the stability of the currency and to maintain full employment. And clearly, right now, we do not have full employment. So it's not clear to me. I mean, why is it that these exchange-traded funds are all about bailing out the corporations, the big corporations, and the bond market, et cetera, basically the stock market, but the little companies that aren't in the stock market that need a loan, you know, that need a cheap loan, that well, I guess there is, you know, the Small Business Association, or what is it, SBA anyway, is doing that. But the states have to borrow, if they get to borrow at all at the municipal liquidity facility or borrowing at whatever, the bond market rate, which is maybe 3% or so, plus a penalty. But these big corporations are not getting a penalty. It just seems to me so biased, and it's not really doing, like you say, it's not doing what the Fed's actual mandate is and what they're actually allowed to do.
Right. I mean, I think it was very telling. I mean, for a lot of these asset purchase programs, the Fed leadership said, well, we have to buy these things because jobs. It's part of our mandate, and also, you know, it's a crisis right now. We have to do emergency lending to try to prop up the economy because jobs. But to me, it was very telling that then when they put out the term sheets for a bunch of the lending programs, that, you know, the CARES Act had these other provisions in them that said a company would only be eligible for a loan or for one of these facilities if they maintained payroll, if they put limits on executive compensation, if they limited things like dividends and buybacks. But then you look at the Fed's term sheets they put out, and they don't really contain meaningful restrictions on any of those areas. So there's the use of jobs as a way to justify the ETF purchases and a bunch of the corporate bond purchases. Well, at the same time, if the Fed was really worried about jobs, they would make sure that those strings of companies maintaining their payrolls and not laying people off were attached to the loans and the purchases, which they did not do. So there's a little bit of sleight of hand that happens with some of this argumentation. So that's what I'm saying, is that, you know, that isn't another example of one of those decisions where they again, try to sort of say, this is a neutral decision. We're just going out there and we're buying whatever securities for whatever issuers. And these are the largest companies we're talking about here. Small businesses don't tap the capital markets. They get financing, but there are a lot of decisions the Federal Reserve makes that are embedded in the way they structure those programs, and not requiring companies to maintain their payrolls is just one example of that.
Yeah, and it looks to me like they're just using this crisis as an excuse to do different things. I had read that, well, we had that whole repo market crisis starting in September, and I remember reading in July that it could be the exchange-traded funds that were in trouble because they were the ones, you can still do a run on, on those markets where everybody tries to get out at once, whereas the banks pretty much, you can't, they're so buffered that we're not worried about runs on the banks anymore, but we can have runs on the repo market and we can have runs on the exchange traded funds. So, it does look like BlackRock just stepped right in and bailed themselves out first and foremost. It just seems so. And then, I wrote an article on this that the Fed had to step in and bail out the repo market month after month after month, and the problem didn't go away. In fact, they got more hedge funds and dodgy players piling in there. So finally they just used the excuse of making small business loans, that they want the banks to be able to make more loans, and therefore they're throwing open their discount window basically for free for any bank in good standing. But really, who are they really bailing out? I mean, they're bailing out themselves from having to bail out the repo market, which is where banks go to get the liquidity to pretend they've actually got the money, which they really don't have because they're really just creating credit on their books. I mean, their whole system is quite messed up, it seems to me. But I am interested in your suggestions for revising things. You also wrote a paper called A Regulatory Green Light, How Dodd-Frank Can Address Wall Street's Role in the Climate Crisis. in January. So I just, can you like give a sort of capsule summary of just some of your ideas for how we would transform the system and make it into something that serves the people instead of just the big corporations?
Sure. Yeah. Thanks for bringing that paper up, actually. That's a really important point. And to my mind, again, another example of the central bank making judgments, decisions that are in some ways political, but also economic, while sort of disclaiming responsibility for those things. And that paper is about the role of the private, of large private financial institutions in financing the climate crisis, how some of the largest private bank holding companies, asset managers, insurers are really behind financing large fossil fuel companies, commodities companies that fund deforestation. And what I argue in that paper is that, one of the Fed has its monetary policy functions. You mentioned the dual mandate of full employment and price stability there. It also has a set of other sort of ancillary responsibilities to that. One is regulation and supervision of bank holding companies and certain state banks. Another is to oversee the payment system. And another that it got after the financial crisis in 2008 was this responsibility for ensuring financial stability. And so what I argue in this paper is that the Fed is one of the few central banks around the world that has not recognized the fact that climate change and a potential climate crisis can also cause an economic and a financial crisis as well. So what I argue in this paper is that, a lot of policymakers frame climate change as a social problem and not a financial or an economic problem. And so what I do in the paper is I sort of run through all the ways in which climate change is going to cause a economic and financial catastrophe that is orders of magnitude worse than what we saw in 2008. There are ways in which actually it has echoes in what we're seeing right now with COVID-19 and some of the disruptions that it could cause. So what I argue in that paper is that the Fed has a responsibility to address the role of the private institutions for which it has responsibility in stopping those institutions from driving this climate change that will cause a climate crisis that will then lead to a financial crisis. So there are a variety of tools about higher capital requirements for them, maybe even limiting the amount of financing and the emissions that a bank can have in its portfolio. There are a variety of measures there, but to my mind, it's one piece of what would be a comprehensive suite of ways of addressing the financing of climate change and moving us towards a just transition, because I see this as I'm excited by a lot of ideas of the ways in which we can do public financing of a green economy. But I also feel like at the same time, it will take time to ramp up some of those programs, and you can't have something like a green bank or a national investment authority that people have talked about. It will simply not be able to compete with a bunch of multi-trillion-dollar private financial institutions if we allow them to just keep operating business as usual, underpricing the risks of the climate-devastating financing that they're doing. So that's sort of the idea. Let's ramp up the stuff on the public side, the financing of a new green economy, but let's not, in the interim, let the Federal Reserve get away with not addressing the risks that are being created in the private markets as well.
Mm-hmm. That's great. And you wrote that before March, there's so many of the old myths that have just been blown, like the idea mm-hmm. that you can't do helicopter money, you can't mm-hmm. Create trillions of dollars without creating hyperinflation. I just saw an article about the Bank of Japan and this whole idea, that they went to negative interest rates on the theory that this would prompt people to spend, and in fact what people have done is save more because they no longer can make a decent interest rate on safe investments, bonds or whatever that pay whatever they used to be. You can make like 10% just on your bonds as a retired person. So they're saving more, and not only is the inflation rate not gone up to 2%, but it keeps going down, even though they bought 80% of their exchange-traded funds, are on the books of the Bank of Japan. So like you say, you've got these central banks that are making all these decisions that sound like they should be decisions made by Congress. We did not elect the central bankers. We definitely didn't elect Larry Fink, and he doesn't, or, you know, BlackRock, and they don't even have any, I mean, at least the Federal Reserve, in theory, is supposed to be a federal institution, though we know it actually works for the banks. But BlackRock is not even pretending to be, you know, a federal agency. It should be. We should, like you said, I guess we have to set up our own federal agency, but we don't have the Aladdin program or whatever it takes to do all those sophisticated things. Yeah. So, but it's definitely a time of change when we can rethink a lot of things.
Well, one point on that, I mean, I think it actually has been really reassuring to see post-2008, there's a lot of stuff. I mean, you know, there are grassroots movements around things like public banking, for sure, and you know that better than anybody else. But there has also been a lot of rethinking in a lot of, like, academic circles about what it is that banks actually do and their relationship between private banks and the central bank and, you know, a re-envisioning of institutions that over the course of, you know, we had all those great reforms during the New Deal and then the rise of sort of laissez-faire economic Chicago school thinking and a whole bunch of other sort of ideological efforts, we started to think about banks as purely private institutions at some point. And there's been a lot of really, to me, interesting and creative thought around what do banks actually do? Are they actually franchisees of our state? You know, we license them, we give them the authority to effectively become monetary institutions on the public's behalf. And so if we think about them that way, then that, to your point, I mean, the way that COVID-19 is sort of opening up a whole bunch of possibilities about the role of monetary financing in a bunch of areas. If we think about these private institutions as effectively, whether you want to call it a public-private partnership, whether you want to call them franchisees, whether you want to say that they provide some of the basic market infrastructure, however you want to conceptually think about that, the point is they're not as private as we talk about often. They actually serve a public function. And so if they do that, then what do we want them to look like? What do we want our financial system to look like? And if we shape our financial system that way, then what are the sorts of things we want to finance? What else can we do? What sort of other public functions become possible once you sort of reorient your thinking about what the nature of the financial system?
Right. Not only are they doing a public function, but they absolutely need the government or they would fail, which we have seen over and over again. First of all, there's FDIC insurance that is what saved the banks in the 1930s. And then even with FDIC insurance, we every 10 years or so, we have to step in and bail them out. So now the Fed has just bailed them out quietly without any strings attached. But who is the Fed itself? I mean, they purport to be independent, but even the Fed has just acknowledged that they can't do all this stuff by themselves. They're not allowed to buy all those things that they're going to buy through the special purpose vehicles. So the Treasury had to set up the special purpose vehicles to get around the rules. It seems to me we need to put the Fed has basically acknowledged that they're not independent. They need the Treasury. Well, we should put some strings on them, but who are we? It would be Congress, which means those few people that seem to talk about such things, and their voices aren't heard very loudly. But it's great that you're there and able to, you know, get their ears and maybe educate them on a lot of things. I mean, I think you're right that a lot of the problem is people just don't understand all these nuances, and they think, well, I'll just leave them to the experts because they trust the experts. So I guess the first thing is to make them not be so trustful and really hear what's going on.
If you want a sort of anecdotal evidence about the sort of lack of interest in what the Fed is and does, try placing an op-ed about the Fed and find out how interested or not some editorial boards are in actually running a piece like that. You know, I think that it puts a lot of folks to sleep. But I do want to get back, you know, you made the earlier point about the repo market and some of those sort of fragile money markets. I mean, I think that's a really important thing to think about, too, is that so much of the financial and monetary history of our country is about private sector entities trying to do private money creation, and the sort of push and pull between public authorities trying to tamp that kind of stuff down. And it feels like of late, the tack the Fed has taken to that has not been to reform those markets, not to clamp down on that stuff up front, but that is effectively said to all these private sector actors that are engaging in all these, they're essentially issuing the hot money that sort of sloshes around the system in good times and is up in the bad times. It feels like the Fed has effectively said in a lot of ways, we'll backstop all this stuff for you. That's the only way we know to maintain stability here. And that feels like another important piece that's lost for policymakers, particularly folks on Capitol Hill, is the Fed is implicitly now standing behind so much of these fragile financial markets. And is that a thing that we want? The Fed can stand behind those private financial markets in that way. What are the other public functions that it could stand behind as well? And again, it's a debate I don't really, it's starting a little bit, there was some draft legislation around the time of the CARES Act and subsequent bills about getting the Fed to establish its own digital currency that then could be more easily distributed to people. But I only hear the start of that conversation now, and I don't hear a full grappling with all the implications of the ways that our financial markets have changed, largely driven by the central bank over the last few years.
Yeah, well, that's great that you're working on it. I have one more question. I doubt our listeners understand this because I don't really understand it myself. What is an exchange-traded fund, or why are they so risky? I remember reading Carl Icahn said that this is, a big hidden danger in the market was that everybody would pile out of them at once. But why is that true more than with stocks?
Sure. I wouldn't say it is more or less true than of stocks. The issue is it's another way to get exposure to certain asset classes, whether it's corporate bonds or stocks. It's another way for retail investors to get access to it. But once you open it up to things like retail investors to make it easier for them to get in and out of it, then you get things like high-frequency trading hedge funds trying to get in and out of them, and sort of moving markets in various directions. So there's the risk there is that depending upon how people invest in ETF shares that they use, if the funds are structured in a way that the fund sponsor is borrowing a lot of money to buy the underlying assets that go in there, and then there's a lot of redemptions in an exchange-traded fund, that could be bad for the fund sponsors. So your BlackRocks of the world, your Vanguards, your State Streets. So there are risks on the sponsor side. But also there are all sorts of ways in which the more sophisticated investors can try to use disconnects between the value of the underlying assets in an ETF and then the prices of the shares of the ETF, try to sort of make money when there are disparities and try to move in and out of different asset classes. So it's just another asset that's easy to move in and out of, easy for sophisticated high-frequency traders to kind of flop in and out of depending upon the way the markets are working. And to just sort of create additional fragility in the financial markets. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Okay. I think I see. So what you're buying, if you buy the exchange traded fund, you can sell on a dime, as soon as you see the market going down or whatever. But for the fund itself to come up with the money, they're going to have to sell some stocks, which it may not be a good time. The stocks may be doing poorly, even though the fund was doing pretty well or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Is that right?
Yeah, exactly. So if the price of the exchange traded fund is higher than the price of the underlying stock that it's owned, everyone's going to try to move out of one and pile into the other and vice versa. So it'll make the prices of both different sets of assets volatile. And then particularly for the funds, again, if everyone's moving their money out of an ETF and into some other kind of asset, it drives the what's called the net asset value of that ETF, the price per share of it down, but then leads to losses at the ETF sponsor.
Okay, great. So we've been, hopefully one of our advisors, Bob Hockett, is attempting to get the governors to get together and get a better deal on the municipal liquidity facility. But what do you think, just having worked there, how do you is there any chance of like changing the rules on these things, or who decides what terms are going to be put on the loans? And how would one go about getting them to change their minds on that?
Mm-hmm. Sure. Well, I mean, one of the issues with the CARES Act is that its legal structure is a little bit convoluted, and it sometimes feels a little bit like the Scarecrow and the Wizard of Oz, where, you know, they come to a fork in the road, and the Scarecrow kind of points one arm in each direction and says to go that way. You know, sometimes when decisions get made, the Treasury points to the Fed and says it's because of the Federal Reserve Act that they have to structure something in a particular way. And then when someone goes and complains to the Fed, they point back to Treasury and say, no, Treasury's in the driver's seat here because of this provision of the CARES Act. The authority is a little bit feels a little bit diffuse, and like each institution can point at the other one and say that it was their fault. But, I mean, fundamentally, those are the two decision makers. And you know, I always sort of come back to Section 13.3 of the Federal Reserve Act that says that any of the emergency lending that the Fed does has to be secured to its satisfaction. And so it can decide, it has a lot of authority to decide what it will accept, the terms and the terms on which it will lend against certain kinds of collateral. So to my mind, that gives the Fed a lot of authority to determine the terms and conditions and draw up the term sheets for all of these facilities. So that would be the institution that I would try to persuade were I trying to look at restructuring the municipal liquidity facility.
Mm-hmm. Well, we know how to talk to the legislature, but how do you get your ideas in front of the Fed? I wonder. I mean, mm-hmm. I suppose Bob knows how to do that, but I just wondered.
Sure. I mean, yeah, Bob knows as well as anyone, having worked in there and being an effective scholar and advocate as he is. But, you know, I also think they are clearly, the central bank is clearly responsive to political pressure. I mean, the energy secretary, the treasury secretary, and the president all said, we need XYZ changes to make these facilities eligible for oil and gas companies. And what do you know? The Federal Reserve made all the changes that industry asked for. So it is responsive to political actors for sure. So that's one route, is kind of the bank shot of going to members of Congress and telling them to make their wishes known to the Fed as well. So that's just one route.
Mm-hmm. Okay, that's great. All right. Well, it's been super talking to you. Do you have any more comments to the public banking group?
No, but as a resident of California, it was exciting to see some state legislation passed on the public banking front, and I look forward to seeing where that stuff goes.
Okay, great. All right, good luck with your work. I'm glad you're
Thanks
writing
so
on this subject.
Thanks.
Bye. I've been speaking with Graham Steele, the director of the Corporations and Society Initiative at Stanford Graduate School of Business.
Well, that's it for this edition of It's Our Money with Ellen Brown. Our thanks to our guests, our sponsor, Public Banking Associates, and to you for listening. Be sure to check out Ellen's latest writings on the economy and the changing world of money by visiting ellenbrown.com. And for more information on public banking, visit publicbankinginstitute.org. For information on how local and state government leaders can obtain professional insight and counsel about public banks from key national experts, visit publicbankingassociates.com. I'm Walt McCree. See you next time on It's Our Money with Ellen Brown.